Welcome to the GoTo Podcast. Each episode covers the brightest and boldest ideas from the world's leading experts in software development. Tune in for practical lessons, compelling theories, and plenty of inspiration. GoTo gathers the brightest minds in the software community to help developers tackle projects today, plan for tomorrow, and create a better future. Stay up to date with the latest in tech through GoTo's top-rated events held online and in person in cities like Amsterdam, London, Copenhagen, and Chicago, and by subscribing to the GoTo Conferences YouTube channel, where you can find thousands more high-quality dev talks. Learn more at gotopia.tech.
Hi, my name is Marit van Dijk. I'm a developer advocate at JetBrains, a Java champion, and I've worked in IT for 20 years, and I'm here with my friend, Andrew.
Hi, I'm Andrew Harmel-Law. My pronouns are they, them. I'm a tech principal at ThoughtWorks, which means I'm a consultant. I get to work with lots of different people doing lots of different cool stuff. And I keep forgetting, but I need to mention I wrote a book as well, which I think we're going to talk about a little bit. So the book's called Facilitating Software Architecture. Because what I do a lot is help people do software architecture. So,
right. So tell us a little bit about your book.
So the book comes from frustrations where I'd work with loads of different clients, and ThoughtWorks would come in. Lots of people will have heard of ThoughtWorks. A customer would have a problem. They would say, "Oh, we'll get ThoughtWorks in. They'll come and help us solve the problem." And the problem was typically around about software. So we would come in with loads of different like. People are awesome developers and loads of XP practices like pair programming and TDD and CI/CD and all of these kind of things. Mm-hmm. And so we do all of this work to build really good code, to set up really kind of high performing teams, to just kind of build the product that hopefully the client was looking for, that the product people were looking for.
Yep.
And because we were good at it and we would, you know, the clients would get better and better at it, the teams would start going really fast. And my job on all these projects was typically to be an architect, maybe one architect on my own or me as a part of a team of architects. And I was realizing that as all of these things we figured out to make the code get into prod faster and to just get out of the way of the code, you know, between get out of the loop, which is like in the developer's head, down into code, into the compiler, and then, you know, and then deploy down to prod. That bit's quick these days. Mm-hmm. But the bigger picture
hopefully, if you have good CI/CD,
the architecture bit where someone would be going, this is the bigger picture, this is where we're all going. Mm-hmm. I was getting stuck more and more. I was becoming a blocker. So everyone else is doing all fast flowing
right.
stuff.
So architecture is actually getting in the way of getting software to production.
Exactly. But at the same time, because everything's more split up and because teams are supposed to be more autonomous or self-managing, you know. So therefore, the idea is we're getting as much out of the way of the devs and the rest of the team who are writing the code. We're trying to get as much out of their way. Therefore, making sure that all of these different independent people who are working on their little independent chain sets and pushing their stuff into source control, we need to keep all that lined up or kind of headed in the same direction. Mm-hmm. So architecture is actually super more important.
Right.
Because everybody's more empowered.
But you're hurting the autonomous teams ivory tower top down.
Exactly.
Right, okay.
And so therefore I was like, one reaction would be to like kind of command and control and just get in people's way. Mm-hmm. And the more I did it, the more
because
I hated
developers
myself.
Because developers love that.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So you get really good feedback from developers. They're like, this is not working, right? So we know what we're doing or whatever. You're getting in our way. It was true. So my big thing was, is there a different way of making sure that the right decisions are being made, that you're getting the software to go in the right direction, but without it having to go through, typically in my case, the mind of some kind of straight white heterosexual hierarchical dude who tells you what to do in an ivory tower, right? In the cliche, it's not necessarily a cliche, because in my experience, people in the ivory towers hate being there as much as everyone thinks they love it. But it has to go through this loop of those people telling everyone what to do.
Yeah.
And that just doesn't work for millions of different reasons.
And in my experience also, I've worked in companies where it felt like the architect's job was to say no.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, totally. Hey, we need to connect this application with this application and it needs to go through this application in the middle. But you can't because that has been on the decommission list for 10 years.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And you need to build it in the replacement system. That is not there yet. We haven't even started working on it.
Yeah.
And for legal reasons, we need to connect these now.
Yeah.
So
exactly. And so all these
fun
things.
Times.
This thing, so these are the kind of things that we get involved in. So in the past, I would try and figure out how to navigate through that. And then I would try and figure out how to communicate my way of navigating it through it down to multiple teams, which is hard. And then at the same time, architecture is evolving, right? So I'm not doing it once. I'm doing it over and over again.
Exactly.
Double hard. So then I was like, instead of that, what if I facilitate the collective, the individuals or the teams, because we're really thinking of things in a team-like kind of unit, mm-hmm. not, you know, not individuals, but teams. If we do that, then does it work? And so I tried a bunch of experiments and it turns out it does. So you still have a lot of stuff to do, but you're not doing software architecture. And that's the title of the book, Facilitating It.
Right.
So you're still making people think about trade-offs. You're still making people think about the big picture. You're still making people think about the relationships between my team and your team.
My application and your application.
Yeah, all of these different things. All of the tech stacks, all of the stuff. But instead of it coming to me to say yes or no or to pick things, I would be facilitating you and your peers and everyone else and like trying to balance, maybe not even balance, but just make everyone aware of the conversations that people who want it to do one way would have, people who want it to do another way, and then kind of bring those conversations together. So that's the kind of the thing that
that sounds super interesting. So I'm thinking about situations where we had architects who needed to decide where a certain piece of functionality would end up.
Yep.
Would it be in this application or that application?
Yeah.
I don't quite see how that would work, maybe in the examples that I have mind, if the teams would have to negotiate that amongst themselves. So then how would you facilitate such a decision?
So it's a really good question. So there's three things that triggered the idea
there
of the book. There's three things that triggered the idea of the book. And so the first one is, there's a quote from Ruth Mallon, a famous architect who I really admire. And so Ruth has this long post called, I think, Are Architects Necessary? So the spoiler alert for the article is, yes, architects are necessary. But Ruth talks about what architects do and comes to the point that the key role of an architect is to make sure that conversations are happening. Now, you don't need to be part of the conversation. You don't need to be like interjecting into the conversation. But what you do need to know is that the right people are having the right conversation at the right time with the right information. So maybe that conversation is happening. So maybe you're speaking to your team, you know, your team is speaking to another team about where does this feature go. If I'm an architect and the whole conversation sounds perfect and sensible and everyone seems to be going in a sensible direction and balancing all of the right things, fine. I could technically leave it alone.
What if both teams are like, well, we understand the company needs this functionality, but it should not go in our application. And the other team is also, it should not go in our, you know.
Exactly.
At some point, someone is going to have to be like, okay.
Precisely. And so this is the thing. The big thing is that what you end up doing as an architect is, instead of telling people what you do, and we'll come on to why that's a problem. You could, your default reaction is, I will now use my escalate privilege. You stop it. You do it. I don't care that you think it sucks and you, like, everyone hates it.
And that's always going to work
happens
out well.
Happens all the time.
Yes.
But what you want to do is bringing to, and this is, so I used to start by like offering advice, because basically the fundamental thing in the book is called the advice process. So you don't seek permission, you just seek advice, and you need to seek advice from people who have expertise in the matter and people who are affected. Right?
And who is seeking that advice? Is it the architect or the teams?
Whoever's making the decision. So what typically happens is, and this is something I learned from speaking to Trond Hjortland, who like studies socio-technical systems.
Right.
Team level decisions, or decisions which are primarily belong to a team, will come from and be decided by a team, but you'll speak to your peers who are affected.
Exactly. You might speak to other teams who have done a similar process or used a similar technology, etc.
Or you're changing their API, so they have a ticket on the backlog.
Exactly.
Or it'll be something like, not at a higher level, but like in between the individual parts, right? So therefore, and just like you said, there is no best place for it to go. Or correct place for it to go, right? So there'll be a trade-off. There'll be a bunch of stuff. So typically an architect, a systems architect or a solution architect or someone, whatever the word is in the company, they'll come along and trade off things and say, right, I think it should go here, but I've listened to this team based on the tech strategy of the company, which is hopefully clear, and on our cross-functional, or we call them cross-functional requirements, non-functional requirements, and our like investments in this technology. So I've been in clients where everyone has wanted to do something exciting with a new, I don't know, some other provider, but the answer has been no. New Relic is who we've just paid for a 3-year license for. So irrespective of the fact that you've all selected this new cool technology, it's going to be New Relic.
Unfortunately,
we just paid
no.
for it.
Yeah,
we just paid for it. not, it's unfair to pick a New Relic, but New Relic seems to be very successful and everyone picks it all the time. So you'll kind of come in, but you'll broker those kind of conversations. And what you want to do is, the key thing is to remind people that there isn't a right answer or a wrong answer or a best solution. What there is a decision which seems to fit right now, which is what ADRs are good for, right? They're a decision in a point of time. Mm-hmm. Based on all of the information we have.
Do we need to explain what an ADR is?
Yeah, we do. This is good because I always forget this. I did a talk about ADRs once and someone afterwards said you didn't explain what it is. So an ADR is an architectural decision record. So a single decision, which is a choice, a selection from one of a different set of course of options. So you might be like, we could do this. This is our problem. Here's our context, which is in the ADR. We can do either A, B, or C. Here is the pros and cons of A, the pros and cons of B, pros and cons of C.
And you therefore we have selected...
And we select one. And when you do the advice process, you write the ADR and then you seek advice from people who are affected, so other teams, and those with expertise, architects, InfoSec. If it's a bank, you'll speak to regulatory because they'll have some strong opinions.
Compliance,
all this stuff, right? So you bring in all of that stuff and you record it on the ADR. So you've got a nice record of the thing and that's how you do it.
And that is also super useful in the future because you... Yeah. Might end up working on code bases where none of the original developers are still there and you find the code and you're like, but why? Why is it like
all
this?
The time.
And now you can go back and at least, okay, because at the time with this information,
You can see what people knew. You can see what the priorities were. You can see because it's missing what they had no clue about. So you'll be like, why did they not
Of course, in hindsight, now we know that that was a bad decision.
In hindsight,
but we didn't at the time. Yeah, we took the best decision that we could have at the time.
Precisely right, precisely. And this is what's interesting. So there's another quote that triggered. So three quotes triggered the book. The first one I've just mentioned that make sure the right conversations are happening. The second isn't necessarily a quote, but it's an experience of open spaces. So seeing... Open spaces are like a way of organizing conferences, where if you do as little as possible and get out of people's way, if people have a shared goal.
Do we need to explain open spaces to people?
Very quickly. So like the open spaces are literally like a forum and a timescale. And the rules are whoever turns up is the right people. Whatever happens is the only thing that could have happened. When it's over, it's over. And there's another law, which is the law of 2 feet. So people propose sessions and sessions happen. There's no lecturing or anything. It's just people sit around in circles talking about things. And if you don't like a session, you can get up and leave.
Exactly.
And everything else
if
miraculously.
If you're not adding or getting value from that session or you're just tired and you need a break.
And so I learned from that, like getting out of, exactly. If you get out of the way, it's a miraculous what happens. So that's the second thing. But the third thing, and this was what kind of, the first two were cool. The third one was haunting. So Alberto Brandolini, who's the famous Italian, very enthusiastic, more enthusiastic even than me, creator of event storming. So he had a tweet, which I'm sure Alberto just thinks amazing thoughts all the time and just tweets them out. But the one that struck me for years was, it's the developer's assumptions that make it into prod, not the diagrams on the wiki, not the high ideals of the product manager, not what the CTO thinks. It's what turned into code, right? So the interpretation of those pages on the wiki and the presentation.
And it might not be what was originally intended. It's the mental model.
It's the mental model.
Mental model of the developer that makes it.
And this was the thing. So this, and on top of all of the stuff, me trying to run around. And so this was my thing. Even if I do great architecture and it's the best decision and it's done well and I've documented it beautifully and it's all in ADRs, if I do it and then fumble the bit where I go to speak to the dev and say, can you code this? It's irrelevant.
Or you don't make sure that they actually understood it in the way that you intended, because communication, of course, goes both ways.
And the other key thing is, even if I do communicate it well, and they do exactly like I say, they then push it down into prod, right? They merge it to master or merge it to main, and then it goes down into prod, and then immediately gets deployed. The reality of running code is going to rapidly tell you whether my decision was a good one or a bad one, or whether customers, whatever, right?
Production is where your code meets reality. Exactly.
Right. So this is the thing. So that's... None of this makes any sense until it's been down, running, being used by someone. So then you close the loop, right, which you get with continuous deployment or TDD or pair programming. They're all feedback loops, right?
Yes.
So you close the feedback loop and you get this valid thing and this shared mental model, the kind of the tightness on it. Like what I thought, writing my ADR, what you thought writing the code. Then we push it down to prod, what the customers and the environment and the traffic and stuff thinks about it. then we get that back and we kind of bring
and
back.
Whether we took all of that into account when we made all of these decisions and wrote all of this code, do we actually properly understand our customers, their data?
All of that stuff. All of which, and so then if you're thinking, right, if I'm going to make a decision, ideally I'd want to take all of that into account. So you do, and you can, which is what this kind of approach does, because it doesn't just mean it has all to has to come all from me as an architect. It can come from me, from you, the marketing person. The best thing I've seen at the moment, my current client, is they get product management to offer advice on ADRs. So product management are like, we know these two are technically awesome and you're all very excited about them, but this one's the one that's going to deliver more value. So the pro for option three, which everyone hates, is like, I don't know, Java 8 or something. They're like, here's an existing Java 8 system and you could push this to prod very fast, so, which doesn't mean it's right, but it's like it adds all of the things, right? So then you've got that all that stuff in the thing. So, but all of this kind of like closing the loop on this mental model, because this is what interests me most about software. So I don't get to write code anymore for various reasons. Number one, because I was probably, because I'm a thought worker, I had to be a certain level of goodness at code, but I'm probably, on most of the projects I work on, I'm the worst developer, which is why I do the architecture and everyone else gets to write the code. But trying to, what astounds me is that, I don't know how anyone ever managed it, but we do manage it. We, as a collective, because nobody builds software on their own these days, right?
Exactly.
Apart from like small open source projects, which everyone depends on. But like we build like teams of 30, 40, 50, 100,000 people build software, which has to go through a compiler and get into production and somehow do a job. It's a miracle to me that any of that ever works ever at all. So there must be.
Well, those are the two states of a developer, right? My code doesn't work and I don't know why. And exactly, my code works and I don't know why.
I know exactly. And this is the thing, is like, how does that? So this is what I want to think about next after post this book, because doing, writing this book, and getting out of my own head and then starting instead to like with the open space thing, you don't create the conference, you create the space for the conference. So with architectural facilitation, you don't create the architecture, you create the space for architecture. If people are making bad decisions, it's not because they're dumb. It's because you haven't given them the skills to make the best decisions, right? Or you haven't listened to them because maybe it isn't dumb, but you just think it is because you haven't discovered what's going on. So stepping back and making more of a space for this shared mental model, which is important for the code. But the other thing that's interesting to me is it's not just the code now, because we don't like do a big lot of designs and then code it up for 3 years and then deploy it to prod.
And
we do like sharp iterations and stuff. Yeah, exactly. And like, so we iterate on stuff, everything evolves. So how we build a thing which turns into code and then evolves over the course of time, and people can still understand, and can be like mental model.
Hopefully. Sometimes they can't.
Exactly. And, right. And this is the thing. So that kind of, because that's the architecture, right? The architecture isn't, it's like when you know, you look at, this is why architecture is a bad word. It's not like one big gigantic building that someone drew on a big piece of paper and then we built, right? It's more like a city with all of this stuff and it's growing and the neighborhoods are changing and all of this stuff's kind of coming and going.
And even the building that you built once, you know, you might strip the outside and rebuild it again, or you might do, I want to say refactoring, remodeling.
But it is kind of like refactoring, right? And this is the thing. So that's, so the interest, because Kevlin Henney talks about this and he's got a really nice, he's got a slide, which I want to steal, where he's got like, it's a photograph of two houses, which are built with the same design.
You know,
and then
you can
he's
just
got,
ask
like,
him for a slide, by the way.
So, and then like, he's like, then like 10 years later, there's two photographs of the same house and like different people have lived in them. And so they look totally different. And you're like, that is, like this is Kevin's point. That is code. Like literally, that's what we're doing. So,
well, only if we live in it.
And
you
this
know,
is
like,
the thing.
Is this the final code? Well, you know, once we turn it off, that is the final code.
Yeah, which never these days. Like, I mean, I know we do decommission stuff, and we decommission stuff a lot less than we ought to, I think. But what's interesting to me is, and which nobody seems to talk about, but I'm more and more interested in, if this is where. Because code is made out of thoughts, or like what we think, right? It's where we live. It's not just what we, I know we build code where people do jobs, but as developers, when we're trying to, you know, I'm trying to come up with an overall architecture. You're trying to code up pieces of the architecture. The QA is trying to test bits of it. The product manager is trying to drive everything in a direction where they think is going to like serve customer needs and stuff. But we don't do that once and then forget about it. We're doing it over and
over
again.
We do that all the time, and we're adding in, like, we're learning things as we do it. We're getting new information.
Yeah.
The world around us changes. The customer's needs might change. A competitor might do something that makes us need to change direction. Then we mentioned dependencies that we use might change, especially if they're being open source dependencies built by, you know, one person somewhere who might decide to go do something else with their lives.
Yes,
so all of these things might change at any time while we are...
And we're trying to just stay on top of stuff. And I think this, again, I've done a talk about this. Like you said, right? People do, we get paid very well to write software. Some people get paid better than others, but you know, compared to lots of jobs, we get paid a lot to write software. But one of the things I'm aware of, like a lot of us, not everyone, but lots of us also do it because we love it, right? So there's this weird thing where we love writing code. We love doing stuff. We want, and like, in my experience, it's not the only reason why it's good code, but if it's got a good architecture, it's where you'll like being a developer. It's where you'll like continuing to write code. It'll make sense when you look at code. And this is what I kind of want to think about maybe in my next book. I need to pitch.
So you're writing a next book?
No, I'm not writing a next
book. You heard it here first, though.
But I do want to like pitch, because like, I do want to know about like the whole, like if there is this longer term relationship and a group of people need to live in a code base and share a mental model and grow and change it and stuff. And one of the ways of describing that is to like use the word architecture. That to me is super interesting. And now we know about socio-technical things. So therefore all of the social stuff also has an impact and all of that kind of thing.
Yeah, and that's one
that to me is super interesting.
That's one of my favorite things is when you have a team that works well together and you're working on a code base and you kind of have a shared mental model, you have a shared history, and it might become difficult if people leave the team or if new people join the team. I saw a tweet once that said teams are immutable data structures. You know, if someone leaves or you add, you have a new data structure.
Yeah.
And that is kind of true because it might change, for lack of a better word, the vibe of the team.
Yeah, totally. It has.
And you have to kind of renegotiate. You have a new teammate. Okay, this is how we've always done things. A new teammate might come in and start to question things, which might be less pleasant, but might also be super useful. And you can learn something from a new person on the team.
It's so this is, and I completely agree. And that's, we don't talk about that. Like, we talk about the bits, the consequences of it, right? So we talk about Conway's law. So like the structure of the system or the information structure of a system will parallel the information passing structure of an organization, et cetera. And then we do inverse Conway to like try and reverse engineer it. But the step before that, we don't really talk about. There's an interesting thing. So for like, one of the later chapters of the book, architects kind of love the kind of top down forward passing type stuff. So I went and read Christopher Alexander's book to go to the source of patterns. And there is loads of stuff which is correctly in software for very valid reasons, which are all about these patterns go down here and then you have a pattern and within it contains other patterns and within that pattern it contains smaller patterns, which is completely valid. What I didn't realize is until I reread the book, there's a whole bit in the book about the process of repair. So there is this kind of top-down big to small communication flow, right? So like big patterns or the big context, a big decision, like someone decides to use Java 8, right? That's going to impact loads of other stuff.
Yeah, that then comes to what kind of dependencies do you use?
Yeah, exactly. And there's a thing, knock on, and then which cloud you can use, right? So loads of stuff happens. But there's also a smaller, but more diffuse. So like there's lots of little voices and the little voices are people complaining that Java 8 can't do all of the things that Java 23 can do, right? And that
it might be able to do the same things, but it's going to be harder on the developers at some point. Yeah. You know, dependencies might no longer work with Java 8.
Yeah,
Spring last year, I think, updated to you have to be running Java 17.
Exactly.
But also you get all of the nice language features that make Java these days so much nicer to use than 10 years ago or, 20 years ago when I first started learning it. And why wouldn't you want to have nice things?
And this is the thing. It's like, that's what I think we ignore from an architecture perspective, which is why I want to think about this too. We still think it's very, even me when I was writing the book, I was like, oh, it's all mostly top down. I was like, but there's all of this stuff. You know, that's a feedback loop, which isn't the feedback of the code in production. That's the feedback of the experience of the people living in that place, which is the people writing the code. So they'll be more aware of stuff. And you'll see it. And this is what, Christopher Alexander talks about this in the book is like, That's the process of repair. So you're not like tearing down the, you know, the roof of your house and putting a new roof on, but you might like build an extension with a different type of roof, right? With solar panels on it or different, more heat, right. You know, so you'll end up with this patchwork of stuff. And I was like, oh my God, this is exactly what we end up with, but accidentally, not consciously. So yes. Now what I want to think about is like, If you could at least number one, acknowledge this happens and then do it more consciously. So even ThoughtWorks has things like Bounded By, which is a blip on the radar from a long time ago. I think it's even dropped off the radar. But its big point was, don't say we're going to use AWS for absolutely everything, because someone will come along, a data scientist typically, will come along and say GCP is better, right? So then you're like, okay, we'll use AWS for everything, apart from all the data stuff, because GCP, because the data scientists say it's better. And then I've been at another client where they were like, we'll do all of this, but one thing we want to use, one, you know, high performing part of our architecture, which is some secret sauce, needs a certain chipset, which isn't available on Amazon. So we'll put it on Azure. So this stuff.
Or there's companies who are like, we want to be agnostic. We don't want to put all of our eggs in one basket. So we're going to use all of them.
Yeah.
Yay. Now exactly. I have to learn all of them.
Exactly. And this is the thing. So like, and this, what I want to kind of, I want to figure out is how I can, because, so the cool bit, the reason the book works, I think, and the reason, works for me anyway, is I mentioned there's a whole big book about facilitating software architecture. Fundamentally, it uses the advice process, which is anyone can decide as long as they seek advice. That's it. You could write it in like a single slide. And then the rest of the 462 pages of the book are like, okay, when you do that, this is what happens. I think there's
another...
But people
should still read the 400 and some odd pages.
Well, so I got told, Martin Fowler recommended that I should, because there's a blog post, which is like 8 pages long or something, which is the summary. And then it turns out you can use a book blog post on Martin Fowler's website to pitch book to O'Reilly and go, I think there's another 400 pages of this. But the core is like very simple.
So that's how that happened.
Yeah, that's how it happened. So that's my thought worker privilege. So it's that. It started as a Twitter rant, actually. Then it turned into an article. And then it turned into a book. But fundamentally, it's just like decisions are important.
So if I continue to rant on social media, I might end up accidentally writing a book.
My blog post on... I don't think it's just thought workers on Martin Fowler's site, actually. Mm. See, sometimes he invites other people. But so that's the core thing. But I think there's this other kind of listening... The habitability of code bases.
Yeah.
You know, if we architect homes, we don't architect homes because they are efficient, you know, places for human robots to live. We architect homes, and this is the whole part of the Christopher Alexander thing, is like, I can't remember what he calls it, but there's a magic or a wholeness or something when you get a building or a neighborhood or whatever, or a room when you get it right, right?
Yes.
And I think, and I want to do a talk about this, and Gregor Hopi and I were chatting about it on LinkedIn. I've probably pronounced his name wrong, but anyway. Gregor, that, we keep forgetting that, but then you see people writing code and the joy, like you said, not always, half the time it's like completely driving you around the twist. But when it's working and when you're working with your colleagues as a team,
yes,
that's magical. There and is actually, that thing there, right, which we don't talk about enough. And I think that's not just a cool thing. I think that's an important signal to pay attention to.
Yeah, and it's when you've been on a team that works really well together, then it's really hard to accept teams that don't, which is my problem because I've been on a team that worked really well together.
It's super hard.
But that does remind me, I kind of wanted to circle back to you likened facilitating architecture to open spaces.
Yeah.
Which really works for me, having been to open spaces. If you haven't, recommend it.
Go to open space.
But the people who go to open space kind of self-select and are the people that are interested in doing it that way.
Yeah.
The people who work on software teams don't always self-select. So I wanted to ask, are there specific things that the people who work on those teams need to have or to be? Is it certain cultures where this works or doesn't work?
Yeah.
I can also imagine companies, especially if it's very hierarchical, if they have to cover their ass all the time, where this would not work. Or I have a hard time imagining working. So this is, what are some of the preconditions?
So it's really good. So the caveat number one, there are less preconditions than you think. What you need to do is, so that this is literally the last, because the book's in four parts. First part is like, here are the basic rules. Second part is, you'll probably need some of these extra things. Please don't do all of them. That's like doing Agile and you end up doing all of Agile, right? Like just do the bits you need. The third part is It turns out decisions are all related. The stuff I was talking about with Christopher Alexander and all these things. The fourth part is about power dynamics, leadership, and building a safe environment within a within a hierarchical organization, because I am not naive enough to think that everyone will magically become
Patagonia. And I think this is what I was going for. I think you have to have a safe environment where it is okay to, you know, openly discuss, we think, you know, this functionality should be in your application or in my application. Mm-hmm. And also to honestly say why you think that rather than have to guard that, because then you're missing out on information and you're not going to get the best decision.
Yeah. And be wrong and fail and like work as a team.
Without, you know, getting smacked upside the head and kind of fired or promoted out.
Yeah. And exactly. And that's why the leadership thing is there, because so you need leadership because you're going to transform and change, right? But it turns out that if you do leadership from top down, or even like servant leadership, which is pretend bottom up, but it's, in my opinion, still top down. What you want to do is all of these things is the word facilitating keeps coming back through it. It's like, if you're the person making it happen, and this goes back to open space, you can't like will an open space into being. You just need to get out of the way. And this is, so if people are interested, actually, the Winter Tech Forum is, which is the first open space I ever went to, is the tickets are open now and it's in Colorado in May, I think.
We talked about that.
Yeah, this is amazing. So like Bruce Eckel runs it and James Ward run it. But what I learned from Bruce is, and this is in the book, Bruce realized that the less you do, the more it works. So Bruce every year, I'd go every year and Bruce would basically have a list of what I'm going to not do this year. But leave Bruce last year. Like, so pretty much Bruce books the church hall where it happens. And I think he books a yurt where there's a dinner.
All right.
And I think it's maybe not in the church hall anymore, and it's probably not in a yurt. But he does two things, and then he posts the date on his website. It's not as simple as this. But basically, then he stands back, and you're like, oh my God, like literally? And then it organizes, and people come together, and there's like two or three people who've been there before, and they all explain it. But even the people now, so when I started coming a few times, I'm like, oh, I'm now taking over, so I should step back. So this kind of wave of people slowly stepping back. And
but that also, again, only works if the people self-selecting understand this and continue to do this.
So this is the thing. What I think is it works broader if, and this is what I've seen, because I checked the first company I tried this with was a client during COVID. So I'd done bits of it, experiments, but I tried
that
it with a company during
might
COVID.
Bring extra challenges.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah. So this is the thing where like, if we're going to do it, let's just like, while COVID's happening, let's try this experiment. So they've been doing it for 4 years. So people said, oh, it'll only work if it's full of thought workers, or it'll only work if, I don't know, a million reasons why it should work, because, you know, but it was like, they were just a regular company building insurance software. It was like, they were just regular human beings doing a good job, not like, you know, Netflixing it and all this kind of stuff.
You need people who want to do a good job.
And this was it.
In a safe space.
In a safe space. And so that was the thing. That was what, so Pete Hunter was the person who did it. He led it, the CTO above Pete and the CEO as well. That's what they did. They gave the permission to do it. I've been other places where you don't have to go that high. And this is what chapter three is about, like creating bubbles. Because sometimes, so when I was a previous consultancy before I was at ThoughtWorks, the team ran, and I've done talks about it. The team ran in a kind of self-organizing way.
Yep.
So the important people, like the HR teams, were aware that I was doing this, because otherwise it would have been a bit of a political disaster. But from the outside, and this is chapter 17, like as long as the team looks like it's writing software, and it's shipping stuff, and it's good architecture, and it's going, nobody really cares, because this is the opening to chapter 17.
And
software people are different culture anyway, right? We've worn t-shirts and jeans to work a long time before everyone else started doing it.
Yep.
So it's kind of like, find, and this doesn't mean everyone, but my experience is, the more you trust people and the more you help people learn to kind of build that trust and be wrong and learn from others.
Yeah.
Again, if someone is smart, like, instead of, you know, what I do, and this again is in the book, don't coach them to be better. Help them to coach other people who they're like, oh, that person's not very smart. I'm like, well, how can you teach that person to be smart? You obviously know things because of 10 years more in the industry.
But also, one of the things that I really like is that we all know different things. Mm-hmm. And again, then we go back to one of my favorite teams that I worked on. Everybody brought different things to the team.
And
just because, you know, you might have 10 more years of experience than me doesn't mean that I might not know things that you don't know.
Totally.
And if you can tap into that and also discuss in the team, like, okay, this is what I know really well. This is maybe what I want to learn or grow into and then help each other. And then you become more than the sum of the parts.
100%. So like, this is like, again, there's a massive diversity thing, but I'm like, and I know DEI is now a dirty word. the teams, the best teams I've worked in is where we are not all like each other. When
exactly.
I've been in teams
because
where we're all like each other, you're like, it's an echo chamber.
Things.
Yeah, and people bring things, including, and this is this person in the book who's called Rita, because Rita was my editor. So Rita isn't a software architect, but Rita would ask amazing laser-focused questions. And so there's a person, there's a young developer in the team, and I have worked with young developers like this. I've learned from developers who were good, and now I've started coaching developers to be this confident, and it does take coaching, right? You don't need to know the answer, if it should be a clean, simple, you know, like everyone's striving for simple, clean, mm-hmm. beautiful, elegant architecture, that means that everyone in the team, not just like the rocket scientist person who's like, you know, got a PhD and, you know, used to work for 7 of the FAANG companies and all this kind of stuff. Everybody in the team should be able to understand it, contribute to it, maintain it,
yes.
and evolve it. That's and harder that's, than you think. And if you can enlist the person with the least experience to go, this is not as clear as it should be, that's super powerful, right?
Yeah.
So you want to
so,
all of those things.
Again, also the team that worked really well, I was able to, you know, they had an open culture of ask all the questions because your yeah. question might trigger something that we
yeah,
haven't
totally.
Thought of.
Totally.
And also the culture was you build it, you run it, you love it. So you run it in production. That means that, you know, if you wrote this change
yeah.
and you're going on vacation and next week we have an incident yeah. on that change, I need to also understand the changes yeah. that you made to the code base so that I can support it when you're not there or,
yeah.
you know, 100%. Whoever might be there.
100%.
And that's
so, yeah,
really important.
Yeah. 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 Like writing code. So like if your best friend has to fix it or if you at 3 a.m. has to fix it.
We
right?
have the, imagine the person who has to maintain it is like, you know, a psychopath. I don't like that. I want to change that to imagine that the person who might be maintaining this is you or someone that
yeah.
you like.
Someone you
and I'm,
really
we're
like,
gonna assume
you
that you like yourself, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Have some empathy towards the people
yeah.
who have to maintain this software,
yeah,
I
totally.
Think.
And again, that comes back to code, right? Because this is, because I'm a DDD super fan. It's true that the two hardest things in software are naming and cache and validation, right?
And off by one errors.
And off by one error.
We did this in the...
And it's true, like naming, like, and, but this is the thing, naming is hard, but the more you involve more people, naming gets easier, which
yep.
is implicit in Eric Evans's book and in all of DDD. It's like, don't come up with a new name, co-create it with the domain expert, right?
Exactly.
They already figured it out.
And that's
100
gonna
years
make
ago.
Your communication much easier, et cetera.
Like, and all of this stuff. So this is, and again, this is why I think there's at least one more book. There's a simple kind of core, which I've expanded out, but what I want to do is kind of track a new path through it and just go, right, there's more of these signals which make a hospitable, well-architected, all of that kind of code base where it all fits together, where we want to work and we want to kind of, or code bases, right? It doesn't even need to be one. How do we put those bits together? That, to me, is super interesting.
And so. Then we could have nice things.
Exactly right. But this is
awesome.
Like if we're so powerful, if we can write code that's so super powerful, why do we write code that's, and I know, right?
I don't think, again, I don't think we set out, also something we discussed in the previous session, I don't think we set out to write bad code. I think,
no.
you know, there might be constraints, time constraints,
yeah.
knowledge constraints, lack of sleep, whatever.
Yeah.
We don't set out to write bad code. And also the world changes and then we have, you know, code rots or,
yeah.
you know, there are newer versions of Java and dependencies might not
yeah.
evolve as quickly or might cease to exist. So.
Yeah,
but I think if we have a place where everybody works well together, wants to do a good job, and is safe to do so,
yeah.
we could have nice things.
Yeah, and then it's
with
not one
that,
person's job, right? So yeah.
No, it's all our jobs.
Exactly.
So is there anything that you want to say as closing remark?
So buy my book. Which I'm being, apparently, so O'Reilly will boost me if I am.
And I guess if they buy your book, the odds of the next book also
yeah, the
increase,
odds of the next
right?
book rise up.
Mm.
So, and if you want to find it more, so, but I've also been advised, as I said, if you go to facilitatingsoftwarearchitecture.com, that's got a free chapter, which teaches you how to set up your own tech radar. But it also has a link to the Martin Fowler blog, which is the shorter version.
Right.
It's got a full chapter breakdown. It's got lots of extra supplementary stuff because it's long, but it turned out it was longer. And then Rita had to teach me the difference between important and essential. So all of the important stuff has been cut out of the book and is on extra stuff. There's templates, there's like worked examples of chain sets of ADRs and
awesome.
All this kind of stuff. So,
so we'll put some links in the show notes and people can start there. And
yeah, and I'd love to hear. Oh, and give me feedback as well. That would be like, this book
feedback
is obviously all based
good,
on
right?
people telling me things. So yeah,
yep.
that would be really good.
Awesome.
Cool. Cool.
Thanks.
Thanks, Mara.
This was great.
Brilliant.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the GoTo Podcast. Head over to gotopia.tech to discover lots more content from the brightest minds in software development.